From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now. Today, the Trump transition made it official. Rick Perry is Trump's choice to lead the Energy Department. If confirmed, that would mean the department's next leader would be the same person who once famously called for its elimination.
It's three agencies of government when I get there that are gone. Commerce, education, and the, what's the third one there? Let's see.
The answer he was looking for was energy. Susan Tierney was Assistant Secretary of Energy for Policy under President Clinton. She later helped lead the Department of Energy transition team for President Obama, and she is now a senior advisor for the consulting firm Analysis Group. She joins us from Denver. Welcome.
Thanks so much, Jeremy.
And what was your reaction to the news that Rick Perry is Trump's choice for energy secretary?
Well, I have to say it came a little bit of out of left field. Although there's a lot of energy-related things that are going on in Texas and did happen during his watch as governor, it really is a surprise that he would be heading up the agency he couldn't remember.
And also, you talk about what's going on in Texas. We should remind people that the point of the Energy Department, or at least the primary focus, is about nuclear material.
Yeah, and I would actually describe it as the science of nuclear material, the science of high energy physics, the science of wind turbines as they go through the air. So there's a really deep scientific core of the Department of Energy.
Well, and give us a sense of what exactly the Department of Energy does, because we should remember that the reason Rick Perry was trying to name that department is because he wanted to get rid of it. And many Republicans believe that there shouldn't be a Department of Energy. But what does it do?
Well, the first big chunk of the Department of Energy is really to make sure that the nation's nuclear warheads are ready and available to be deployed and to sit as a deterrent for a variety of different kinds of horrendous things that we could imagine associated with nuclear bombs. So about 40% of the budget has to do with the support for the scientific core that allows the nuclear security to be available without testing those weapons in the atmosphere. A second chunk of the Department of Energy is dealing with the legacy of many, many years of nuclear testing. And so about a fifth of the department is really addressing cleaning up lands that were contaminated by the weapons program. Another fifth has to do with high energy physics and making sure that the nation's scientific core on the physical sciences is world class. And then another fifth is really the energy programs. And that is broken down from everything from supporting advanced nuclear reactors for commercial operation, supporting oil and gas development technologies, renewable energy technologies, cybersecurity on the nation's grid, just all sorts of things that are related to energy. So you probably heard me backing into the energy role.
Yeah.
But that's only a fifth of the agency's work.
Well, and the current secretary, Ernest Moniz, is a nuclear scientist.
Absolutely, a world-class nuclear scientist, and that has enabled him to sit in the agency in a way that I think no other secretary before him, including another Nobel Prize-winning scientist, Stephen Chu, was able to do. Ernie Moniz is really knowledgeable excuse me, about the underpinnings between these different parts of the whole holding company, that's the Department of Energy.
Well, one of the things that Ernest Moniz did is he helped out with the Iran nuclear deal. And obviously, as we've said there, it's something that he knows something about. What role do you think a Secretary Perry would have in either negotiating a new deal or just getting rid of the one that we have now?
Well, let me start by saying that I hope that a Secretary Perry would not dismantle the current deal. I think it's a really important element of our national security for years to come. That said, I think that any Secretary of Energy really has to surround themselves with trusted advisors and experts in the organization who can help with some aspect of the agency's mission that may not be at the fingertips of the secretary, him or herself.
One more thing I want to ask you about, Susan Tierney, and that is the story that the Trump transition team had put out a questionnaire for members of the Energy Department, and part of it asked for the names of employees and contractors that have worked on climate change issues and attended climate conferences. Now, the Energy Department says they're not going to have their employees respond to that, but what were your thoughts about that?
Well, I was stunned at what appeared to be a real ferreting out of individual people, including career staff who have spent the years of their lives working on things that any administration would be asking them to work on. So it seemed to me as though it was off base, and there's lots of other things that the transition team is looking at and is appropriately looking at in terms of important issues that need to be addressed in the early days of the administration.
That's Susan Tierney, who was Assistant Secretary of Energy for Policy under President Clinton. She helped lead the transition team for energy under President Obama, and she's now Senior Advisor for the consulting firm Analysis Group. Susan Tierney, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Well, now look at the so-called gig economy. These are people making a living driving for Uber and Lyft and other app-based jobs. According to the Brookings Institution, this group is growing faster than traditional payroll jobs. The study also found the number rising faster in Nashville, Tennessee, than in nearly any other American city. But what the study didn't tell us is who these people are. Well, Mariba Knight from Here and Now contributor WPLN spent a day gigging her way around Nashville, and in an unscientific survey found that for certain types of workers, being an independent contractor rather than an employee can have its benefits.
It's 6:15 a.m. on a recent weekday, and rather than get in my car, I open my rarely used Uber app. 7 minutes later, Vincent Campbell rolls up.
Campbell? Like the soup.
Okay.
I like using it.
This 62-year-old retired police officer spends about 4 hours a day driving for Uber. Enough to make a little extra for things like tickets to a Titans football game or a splurge that his pension might not cover. Campbell's been Ubering for a little more than a year now. It reminds him a bit of what he enjoyed about being a cop, not being stuck behind a desk, talking with people, and, in his view, making a difference.
And I always have said it from the beginning that I'm saving a life by what I'm doing now. Could be saving my own. I love it when a person tells me, yeah, I'm going out to drink tonight, but I decided to take Uber. I said, I'm so glad you did that.
Campbell loves the flexibility of his Uber gig. Of course, he doesn't need health insurance or a 401k, neither of which Uber offers. And as a retiree, he can handle the unpredictable wages. I'll say up front that the people I met had their own reasons, but they all had positive feelings about the work they do. Take my next encounter, for example. He came with hot chicken.
I was in between jobs, had my own car. I really liked the opportunity to make my own schedule so that way I could be available for my family and help out.
30-year-old James Silva has been doing the meal delivery service Postmates full-time since April. After 10 years in the military, food delivery is a nice in-between job.
It's mindless work, you know, but it does pay the bills.
Plus, Silva says he loves doing it in the midst of Nashville's fast-growing food scene. Every day, as the city's population keeps growing, it seems like a new restaurant opens, and he's there.
That's a microcosm of what's happening in the city.
And with that, he was off to pick up his next meal.
Nice. All right.
Thanks.
Have
so
a good day.
Much.
Take
you
care.
Too. Bye.
A few hours later, I request my ride home. A Nashville native picks me up. Tyler Coker is in between sales jobs, so he started driving for Lyft and Uber. Coker is a classic 20-something, thrown a little off-center by a sluggish economy, and he knows this gig won't last forever, even if he wanted it to. Ride-hailing companies have their eyes set on driverless cars.
These jobs aren't going to be around that long. I would say 5 years. I mean, I guess that's long enough for some people, especially the people that are like me that are just in between.
Driving for Lyft works for a young person biding his time before committing to a career. And on the flip side, Nashville's growing number of young people are eager consumers of what's been dubbed the sharing economy. Mark Murrow, a senior fellow at Brookings, says that all the newcomers have made the city an early adopter.
You have a lot of millennials who don't really relate to car ownership in the normal way.
And then, you know, and are very oriented towards social media and sharing platforms. So to me, it's, you know, being, having fast growth on this sort of does say quite a lot about a city.
My final meeting of the day was with Tina Fravel.
Hi. Got a little tripped up by your driveway.
The 31-year-old worked as an art teacher at a public elementary school in Nashville until she lost her job last year. She was burnt out anyway and ready for a change. So she started working for Shipt, a company that sends people out to buy your groceries. Between gas and taxes, she earns about $10 to $20 an hour. Not as much as teaching, but she welcomes making her own hours and not having a boss to check in with. And Fravel even runs into her former students once in a while.
I see the kids sometimes at Publix, and they're like, hey, Miss Fravel, and I'm like, hey, guys.
Fravel is surprisingly content. In fact, everyone I met was. The retired cop, the ex-military guy, the sales rep. So while the gig economy, which is growing exponentially in Nashville, may get a bad rap at times, for these folks, it was a good and gainful pit stop in the midst of life changes. For Here and Now, I'm Mariba Knight in Nashville.
More than a year ago, an FBI agent repeatedly and futilely called the Democratic National Committee to try to tell them they'd been attacked by Russian hackers. Then John Podesta, Hillary Clinton's top aide, got a warning from Google that someone was using his password. Click here to change it. The campaign's IT guy wrote, "That's legitimate." Later, he said he meant to write, "That's illegitimate," and it's plagued him that Podesta clicked on and let out all campaign documents. Those details are found in today's New York Times front page investigation into the election hacking. Reporter Eric Lipton joins us. And Eric, an FBI agent can't get through. That sounds impossible.
It really is sort of extraordinary, chilling, depressing. But that's what happened. The FBI called into the switchboard at the Democratic National Committee in September. Special Agent Hawkins is his name. And he called to tell the DNC, which was helping run the presidential campaign for the Democrats, that there was evidence that there was a Russian hacker that was inside their computer system. And this is September of 2015. And he told them that it was some operator that went by the name of the Dukes, which is the name that's ascribed to one of the known Russian actors, cyber warfare players. Mm-hmm. And so the DNC technical IT guy didn't believe that the caller was actually an FBI agent. He thought he was being spoofed. And so he didn't take it quite seriously. And the FBI agent kept calling him back again and again. And in fact, started to leave voicemail messages for this DNC IT guy on his phone. And the guy did not call him back. He did check the computer, but he did not find any immediate evidence of the problem. And just sort of was never sure if this was a true FBI agent because they never met in person.
As this was going on and on and on for months, I'm reading your article and I'm thinking, well, why didn't the FBI agent just get up and walk a couple blocks down to the DNC or contact somebody else, higher up in the DNC? You asked that question as well. Why?
It's a really good question, and it's baffling and frustrating for everyone. Because in retrospect, it makes no sense at all. But the FBI agent is charged with notifying individual parties that are the apparent targets of cyber attacks. In this situation involving a presidential campaign, the Democratic National Committee, the target of the Watergate break-in back in 1972, you would have thought that they would have escalated this. If they didn't get a proper response, that the agent would have told his boss and said, you know what? Let's call the executive director or the chairwoman of the DNC, or let's walk over there. And they just, for whatever reason, they didn't do that. So this dragged on from September, all the way through April of 2016. It's extraordinary.
Failures on both ends, on the end of the DNC to hear the message and on the FBI to deliver it. Give us some background here. How much of this kind of hacking had been going on previously? I mean, the FBI knew about this.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of part of the problem is that there were so many of these like phishing expeditions where these emails would come in and they'd say you need to change your password or, they trying to get you to click on something so they could gain access to the computers. So much of that is happening that to some extent, it's like so common that they figure, well, it's probably not real. It's probably not a real threat. So, a lot of this has been going on, though, with federal agencies and, with the Office of OPM, personnel management, the Joint Chiefs of Staff were also hacked. I mean, all kinds of federal agencies have been targeted and successfully infiltrated. And so, you know, in fact, the DNI, the Director of National Intelligence, had warned that the presidential campaigns appeared to be a target of cyber sleuths back in 2015. And so there was certainly ample notice that this was a potential problem.
Well, an underscore for us, because in just Googling around in July, Politico was writing that everybody just assumes that it's not just the Russians hacking, but the Russians hacking to influence an election. But how stunning was this to American officials that this wasn't just espionage, which has been going on for decades, but this was influence?
Right. That's the thing that really distinguished this. And I think that perhaps people didn't appreciate the potential consequences of hacking. And, you know, both the American government and the Russian government for decades have been essentially spying on each other and observing elections, collecting information as they try to anticipate what might happen in the outcome of the election. So that's normal spycraft. What's very abnormal is to take the information that you obtain through these, you know, intelligence gathering and then to put it out in the public domain in an effort to try to influence the election. That only started to happen in June of 2016. And at that point, it was a whole new ball game, and it became an historic event.
Well, and you have Fancy Bear and Cozy Bear. These are what?
Those are the code names given to two different actors that are hackers that are presumed to be from Russia and that have both of which apparently have ties to the Russian government and its intelligence services. And both of them infiltrated the Democratic National Committee computer system at two different times. And it appears that they almost were not even aware that each other was there because they were collecting a lot of the same information. So it was both of them. One of them came in apparently in July of 2015. The second one came in March of 2016. And by the time they were both detected, which was at the end of April 2016, they had already taken tens of thousands of documents, which they then would spew out across the public domain through the rest of the presidential election.
We've heard about the agonizing in the Obama White House over whether or not to say something. Take us a little deeper in that. You talk about Donna Brazile, who became the temporary head of the DNC after Debbie Wasserman Schultz was forced to step down because of what the hacking revealed about her emails. You talk about Donna Brazile going to Reince Priebus at the RNC and begging him to please, can we say something together about this? He declined. To give us a little more of what was going on behind the scenes.
The Democrats were desperate to have both the administration and the Republican Party make a public statement condemning, first, acknowledging that this was a Russian attack, and secondly, condemning it and saying, we as Americans will not accept interference in our democratic process. Because, you know, then everyone would have looked at these emails and documents that were coming out differently. They would have looked at them as stolen property by a foreign power that was trying to influence American democracy, and we would not have been so caught up in the gossipy content of the emails themselves. But the Obama administration was really frozen and unsure how to respond to the Russian hack. It didn't want to be blamed for tipping the scale in the election. It also didn't want to provoke a excessive response. It didn't want to escalate with Russia, where the Russians would then do a counter cyber attack, and perhaps they would release secrets that they'd collected from the United States intelligence services. And so they were worried about escalation. They were worried about being blamed for the outcome of the election. They also presumed that Hillary Clinton was going to win. So they didn't think it was really necessary to take such a dramatic step. So they stalled and stalled and stalled. It wasn't until the early October that they finally attributed it to the Russians, even though they had were definitive evidence in April. And then they never really publicly condemned the Russians or took retaliatory action.
Well, and talk about that. First of all, we should say the CIA in its recent reports isn't saying that the Russians succeeded in tipping the election. But you make clear how much Democrats were preoccupied with trying to figure out what the heck was going on. But what about now? Because, as you say, the White House was reluctant to say anything to appear that they were trying to influence the election themselves. But as a result, there's been no strong statement from the White House, and there are other players. North Korea comes to mind that might read that as what? I mean, what's the concern?
Well, it's interesting. If you look at the North Korean hack on Sony, and in that situation, Sony makes a movie that's spoofing the North Korean leader. Then North Korea does a cyber attack on Sony, takes thousands of its emails, puts them into the public domain, embarrasses Sony in a way that leads to the resignation of their top movie executive. And when that happened, the Obama actually came into the White House press room and said, we're not going to stand for this. We're not going to let, you know, the North Korea intimidate the United States or censor our movies. And he really, you know, boldly condemned it. And it put pressure on the media to be reluctant to use some of the material that was stolen, although, you know, to some extent, the media still used that stolen material. But in this case, there was no such, you know, very bold public declaration of condemnation. And there was no, you know, retaliation. I mean, you have to be careful. What could we do to retaliate? We don't want to go to war with Russia. But, you know, there could have been sanctions applied to individual players who they confirmed were involved in the hacking. It wouldn't have had much effect. I mean, but it would have been a symbolic, you know, statement that this is something that's unacceptable to the United States and to the American democracy.
Well, you are critical of the media, including The Times as well, that, well, the media got played.
It's true. I mean, we were handed essentially a weapon, and we became the delivery mechanism for that weapon. And the media got way too caught up in the gossipy content of these emails, and without thinking about what we were becoming actors in a plot that was intended to disrupt democracy. And so, I think that too many reporters were just taking this stuff and putting it out there without contemplating enough, you know, the role that they were playing in a foreign entity's efforts. And particularly when Guccifer II, who was the front that apparently the Russians put up to, you know, with a website to distribute this information, was offering individual reporters the right to get specific documents that weren't in the public. And so there was all these email exchanges going on between Guccifer II and individual reporters from different news organizations. That seems really inappropriate to me. If you're going to, you know, you're not only is it stuff that's put out in the public and you say, well, it's already public, but in this case, you're going and asking for stuff about individual house races, for example, and then you're publishing it, and then you're torpedoing an individual house candidate. That seems like you're really sort of stepping over the line.
Well, it's going to be taken up for years to come. Eric Lipton, investigative reporter with the Washington Bureau of the New York Times, will link you to their terrifically researched story at hereandnow.org. Eric, thank you.
Thank you.
Eric joined us by Skype, by the way, and his article also details how Russian fingerprints were found on the hacks, how Julian Assange bragged that WikiLeaks was the most referenced political topic the month before the elections. Again, the article. And your thoughts are welcome at hereandnow.org. Amazon announced today that it's made its first delivery by drone, a bag of popcorn, and Amazon's Fire TV, that device that allows you to watch TV on the internet, were delivered to a British man outside of Cambridge in the UK about 13 minutes after he placed his order. It was all part of a new limited trial, but it's not expected in the U.S. anytime soon. Joining us to explain, Maggie Lake. She hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake. Hi, Maggie.
Hi, Robin.
And so we're assuming this was like a rural area, not downtown London.
Yes, I think that's safe to say. It
right.
It is the countryside.
Right. Well, Amazon released a video showing how the delivery worked. Let's listen to a little.
From takeoff to landing and return, they operate completely on their own. Cruising quietly below 400 feet, carrying packages up to 5 pounds, and guided by GPS. Our systems are designed to find their destinations safely.
Well, we understand in this case, this man had a platform on his lawn and they had a launch pad. Amazon had a launch pad at one of their centers. First of all, why is Amazon so intent on doing this?
Well, first of all, I think it's certainly going to save them costs. And, you know, Robin, I was really surprised to see the company says that more than 3/4 of their packages are under 5 pounds. Like, clearly, they haven't been to my house with the gigantic packages that are on my doorstep. But if something like 80% of deliveries shift to drone, think of all those UPS deliveries that don't have to happen, the trucks, the drivers. But I also think this is a long-term strategy on the part of Amazon to really build up loyalty among Prime subscribers, you know, attempt to keep all of us sort of trapped in the Amazon universe and service all of our needs.
Well,
there.
And just to underscore, the package that gets delivered has to be under 5 pounds in this
yes.
program that they're
yeah.
doing. But they're not able to get these deliveries approved in the U.S. That's why they're doing these trials in England, because of requirements like, for instance, that drones be visible to the operator when they're flying. So how, you know, is that expected to change?
I don't think anytime soon. The FAA is opening the process of reviewing this month, but there are major safety concerns, and a lot of them are obvious. You know, will these drones crash out of the sky? Will they hit people? What happens when the air is full of traffic with them? Interestingly, Amazon's beta testing may help build up a bulk of evidence to put some of those fears to rest. I think the bigger worry may turn out to be security. Can these drones be hacked and turned into weapons? That cybersecurity risk may take longer to resolve. And by the way, it's one that exists when it comes to driverless cars as well. It's a big issue.
Well, but there's some precedent. Some companies are doing this, right?
Yeah, we've had these sort of, and I think you've seen them all over the internet, right? Domino's experimented with delivering a pizza in New Zealand. Google has been working very hard on this. They delivered a burrito. I don't know why. Fast food is really tied in here, but I guess a Munchies at Virginia Tech. But they are serious about it, 7-Eleven. But these are all kind of one-off preliminary tests. Amazon seems to be the first one testing significantly. I will say, though, drone use is happening much more frequently in China, where they don't have this kind of regulation. They have a retailer there, JD.com. They have a fleet of drones they are using in rural areas. And it's also why one of the biggest makers of drone and most successful one is DJI. So the Chinese, in many ways, are leading on this.
Well, UPS is also experimenting to try to get medicine delivered to rural areas, which would be another probably really important use of it. Well, we'll continue to see. Right now, there's just two customers that are being tested.
That's right. Let's hope it's medicines first and not burritos our sake.
That would be good. Maggie Lake hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake. Maggie, thanks as always.
Thanks, Robin. Thanks for having me.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said this week that the Senate will vote at the beginning of the year to repeal the Affordable Care Act. We still don't have any details about what Republicans plan to replace it with, and a repeal could put insurance companies and their customers in a difficult position. Joining us now is Cece Connolly, who is CEO of the Alliance of Community Health Plans, which represents nonprofit community health plans, and also the author of Landmark, the Inside Story of America's New Healthcare Law and What It Means for Us All. Cece, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
And first of all, what is your expectation at this point about what is going to happen with Obamacare? Because we've heard Republicans talk about repeal and replace. We've heard them talk about repeal and delay or just repeal.
Well, I guess my answer would be repeal and ... There is absolutely an internal discussion going on within the Republican Party right now. The Trump transition team, some of the nominees to lead our Department of Health and Human Services, Senate Republicans, House Republicans, they have a number of different opinions on the best way to proceed. But one thing is certain, there will, early in 2017, be a vote to repeal the major portions of the Affordable Care Act. That will almost certainly include a delayed effective date, maybe 1 year, maybe two or three. That's another thing they're still arguing over. But that's intended to give everyone some time to think about what is the replace portion.
And does the Alliance of Community Health Plans take a position on what should replace Obamacare?
We are not there yet. It took a long time to come up with the very complex elements of the Affordable Care Act. And so it is our view that we need a sufficient amount of time and conversation with patients and providers and policymakers and everyone else to work through what would be a good set of alternatives. One thing that we're very concerned about in the immediate future is that we don't want any disruption for patients who are presently covered. So we're very concerned about the uncertainty and the instability to the market.
Donald Trump has said he wants to keep certain parts of the health care law, including the ability for people to allow their children to stay on their plans up to age 26, and also making sure that insurance companies can't deny coverage to people with pre-existing conditions. My question to you is the insurance industry going to accept keeping those things without the individual mandate that requires people to have health insurance?
Well, we certainly agree that those are good and popular consumer protections. The individual mandate is one kind of stick, if you will, if you think about carrots and sticks to get people to enroll for health insurance, quite honestly, a lot of the subsidies that help lower income Americans purchase that health insurance coverage and give them some pretty good discounts, we have seen that those subsidies are the very important carrot for a number of people, millions, purchasing health insurance. So this is why it gets so tricky on the replace part of the discussion, because it's not as if an individual mandate is a silver bullet or any particular subsidy is a silver bullet. It's really assembling that jigsaw puzzle in a way that all of the pieces come together and kind of link up.
Do you think that the subsidies are likely to go away?
Well, we're concerned. What we saw from the Republican Congress a year ago when they did kind of a legislative test drive, the subsidies would have disappeared. The Medicaid expansion would have also gone away. And so really, the conversations that we're trying to have with policymakers right now is, okay, so let's take a look at other ways that you can make insurance affordable enough so that you still have those tens of millions of Americans covered.
Cece Connolly, one of the criticisms of Obamacare is that premiums have continued to go up and that people are paying more and more for health insurance. Is there anything about any replacement plan that you're seeing that leads you to believe that that will change, that premiums will start to go down with a repeal and replace?
I don't think any of us should expect our healthcare costs to go down. Are there ways to make health insurance and healthcare more affordable? Yes, absolutely. Some of it has to do with being able to design some insurance products a little more flexibly. So when you think about a young person may not want to purchase a bells and whistles insurance policy because they may not need it in their 20s or 30s. Right now, prescription drug costs are the biggest cost driver in our healthcare system. We've got to get a grip on drug prices or premiums will just keep rising.
That's Cece Connolly, who is CEO of the Alliance of Community Health Plans, which represents nonprofit community health plans. Cece Connolly, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Well, good nutrition does help in trying to stay healthy, but many low-income families struggle to afford the right food. Moms and kids who qualify can participate in the federal program geared toward early development, but once kids turn 5, they're no longer eligible. Harvest Public Media's Christopher Husted reports on how that gap can put families at risk.
It's 7:30 in the morning at Battle Elementary School in Columbia, Missouri. Students hop off of their buses, head down the hallway past a few folding tables with crates of milk, juice, fruit, and warm muffins sitting on top. Lena Fulham is the Director of Nutrition Services for the Columbia Public School District. Here, it's not just low-income students who pick up a free breakfast on the way to class.
It's for all students, which takes the stigma away from students eating with us. So everybody's doing it, so it's just the natural thing to do at the beginning of the day.
For low-income families, putting nutritious meals on the table can be challenging. To pick up the slack, the country schools, with funding from the Ag Department, served 1.8 billion free breakfasts in 2015, and even more free or cheap lunches. Even with free meals, Fulham says she knows many of these students are still hungry at home.
The one thing we do notice is that students eat a lot on Monday and eat a lot on Friday because a few of them, when they go home, know there's not going to be much there.
So what about the kids who aren't in school yet? That's what the WIC program is for. It's called Women, Infants, and Children, and it provides food and other benefits to some 8 million moms and young kids nationwide.
At that time, if I didn't have it, it would mean my kids not having enough during the day to eat.
Chantel Dos Remedios was pregnant with her second child when she and her husband both lost their jobs. She depended on WIC for the extra help.
It was such a great help when you have nothing coming in until you can get back on your feet again.
But the WIC program only provides benefits to children under 5. When Dos Remedios' first son turned 5, he still hadn't started kindergarten, so he couldn't take advantage of free school meals. That donut hole, the gap between aging out of WIC and starting school, hits thousands of families, Dos Remedios says, and she wishes that gap was bridged.
I believe that would help a lot of parents because it is an additional cost for a whole year providing the extra food until they can get into a full day kindergarten or a full day school.
Our research showed that there's a spike in food insecurity right around this age point when children lose eligibility for WIC.
Colleen Heflin specializes in food policy as a professor at the University of Missouri. She recently published new research looking at kids who fall into this gap. She found that losing a food package, which includes juice, cereal, and milk and eggs, for one child, can plunge the whole family into an unstable situation without enough food.
There are physical effects, mental health effects, cognitive effects. We know there's differences in family functioning and even somewhat obvious things like families are less likely to eat meals together, which we know has impacts on all sorts of positive pro-social behaviors.
When children fall into this gap, the families sometimes enroll in SNAP or food stamps, while others shop at the food bank. But Heflin says there's a solution. Extend WIC eligibility to age 6.
And this would, for most of the children in our sample, close that gap entirely.
A bipartisan bill in the U.S. Senate that would raise the age cutoff just died in negotiations with the House. Douglas Greenaway is president of the National WIC Association, which advocates for low-income families. He says he's disappointed, but that the fight will continue with the next Congress.
We ought to be doing everything we can to facilitate ease of access and reducing those barriers. So, let's streamline access to the program.
He says ultimately, though, with the new presidential administration and a farm bill to hammer out, it's anything but assured that a child nutrition bill will pass. For Here and Now, I'm Christopher Husted.
The holidays are a time of traditions. Many people return home to celebrate the holidays, as they always have. But what happens when you get married, or you move out of state, or you want to start new traditions? Juno DeMello is trying to figure this out. She wrote about it for Glamour.com in an article called "Sorry Parents, Why My Husband and I Are Celebrating Christmas Our Way This Year." Juno, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you so much for having me.
And what made you decide it was time to do things your way this year?
Oh, gosh. Well, it was the first year that my husband and I hosted Christmas, and we'd done it my parents' way, we'd done it his parents' way, and we were kind of bringing both families together for the first time and trying to combine their traditions.
Traditions last like what? Year, what are some of the traditions you had to put together?
We had very sort of different ways of celebrating. So he is from Michigan. His father is British, and they do a very proper, formal, seated dinner with so much silverware and cloth napkins, and it's beautiful. And I'm from California. We have a very informal, rolled tacos, throw out some baby carrots for the reindeer, casual way of celebrating. And so we were trying to combine those, and it was really a little stressful for me. So this year, for the first time, we're going to try to do our own thing while still making my in-laws feel welcome.
And how do you decide what your own thing is if it's the first time that you're doing your own
thing? Well, so we've been in Portland a couple of years now, and we have cut down a tree every year. So that is our thing, nothing we ever did growing up.
You cut down your own tree?
Yes. So we go to the Christmas tree farm with a little saw and walk around and kneel down and cut it down.
How very Clark Griswold of you.
Yeah.
But you've never gotten caught underneath a semi truck in your car while doing that?
No.
Okay.
No.
Good.
What else do we do? We have our lights that we strung up for our wedding, which we use every year as our Christmas lights, even though they are very Charlie Brown Christmas. And we have gotten everyone to agree to give just one present a year, one present per person instead of five or six, which can feel like overload.
Well, which is something, by the way, I'm from a family of seven kids, and we have decided over the last many years, instead of buying something for each person, that we have kind of a secret Santa, and we just pick one, and we only have to focus on one, and then it's a better gift.
Yeah, I think that, it can get, you don't want to spend all of December shopping online for 1,000 presents. It's nicer, I think, to just focus on one thing. We haven't gotten to Secret Santa level, but we're somewhere in between.
So does the fact that you're doing Christmas yourself and your way this year make it less stressful?
Ooh, well, we'll find out. I think it should. I think we're compromising. We are still doing a traditional roast turkey, which is important to my in-laws. And I want to, you know, I want to make them happy too. But we are also making a kale salad and roasting the Brussels sprouts instead of boiling them. And Christmas Eve, we're going to order pizza because I didn't want to cook twice. So I'm hoping that everyone feels like they got kind of just enough to feel like they are keeping with tradition while also sort of opening themselves up to what I hope will be our tradition someday.
Well, and just listening to you talk about it and write about it, it's clear that you've put a lot of thought into this, that this was something that was bothering you before and you feel like this is going to make things better.
I mean, I think at a certain point in your adult life, and I've talked to a lot of friends about this, you have to kind of set off on your own. And that doesn't mean you discard everything that you grew up with, but we're incorporating some of those elements and kind of also stepping out on our own.
Why do you think that a holiday that is supposed to be about joy is for so many people so stressful?
Oh, good question. I think you're doing a lot of things out of the ordinary and you're only doing them one time a year. So maybe you're cooking foods that you don't really know how to cook. And one day out of the year, you're attempting all these things. And there's a lot of pressure because there's a lot of people partaking in them and you want to impress them. And then the gifts, you know, you want to give a gift that really makes the person happy and multiply that by 8 people, let's say, who you're giving to. It's a lot of pressure to, I don't know, it's a lot of pressure to deliver joy, which can kind of sap your own joy. So I think it's about finding a balance between wanting to make the people you love happy without driving yourself insane.
Do you think that decades from now, the next generation in your family is going to want to do it their way and you're going to be annoyed by that?
I've thought about that. You know, I like to think that my future self, if I go to my children's house, will go along with the program and do what they want to do. I'm sure I will grit my teeth through certain things, but I like to think that I will be open to their traditions, whatever they may be.
That's Juno DiMello, a freelance writer who wrote Sorry Parents, Why My Husband and I Are Celebrating Christmas Our Way this year on Glamour.com. We'll link to it at hereandnow.org. Juno, thanks so much and Merry Christmas.
Thank you. Merry Christmas to you, too.
Or not.
Yeah, maybe not this year. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.